This is Fresh Air. I'm Arty Moss-Cohen. My guest, Palestinian emigre author Fawaz Torki, writes in his new book, Exile's Return, "I'm a Palestinian, a man without a country. I am free to make any and every country I live in my own. No man can claim a more exalted kind of freedom." This positive spin on his forced exile is not the only point of view that he has that is at odds with the Palestinian leadership in the Middle East. At times in his life, Torki was active in the Palestinian resistance movement, but he has come to be one of its harshest critics. Torki was born in Palestine and as a boy emigrated with his family to Lebanon in 1948. He left for Australia as a teen where he held odd jobs and went to college. At 26, he left Australia for, as he put it, Woodstock Nation, a trip through Asia and Europe with drugs and women. In the early 70s, Torki cut his hair, joined the Palestinian movement, and started writing. Since then, he's written three books about his exile and has contributed op-ed pieces to major newspaper. He's also a poet and has taught at major universities in the United States, where he's lived for the last 21 years. I asked him to tell us what his life was like as a young boy in Palestine.
My father, at least, was a petty shopkeeper, and essentially I grew up in a sort of environment that was working class, but we were essentially self-sufficient. We never went without, and economically we were fine.
Did you have Jewish friends growing up?
I had one Jewish friend growing up when I was about seven, maybe eight. And one day, I talk about this in my book, one day I walked up to him and I said, would you like to play? And he said, no, my mother told me I cannot play with Arabs. And so that, of course, was crushing for me. And that was the beginning of a kind of existential, though I was too early to think of that, it was a kind of existentially shocking sort of experience for me.
Had your parents ever admonished you about playing with Jewish children?
Yes, they did after that, yes. Yeah, there was a kind of progressive alienation between the two communities in Palestine. Roughly around that time, meaning the, 47, 48, 49.
Well, in 1949, your family was forced to leave, and you went to a refugee camp in Beirut.
Uh-huh.
What were the conditions like there?
Well, I mean, obviously, economically, they were not that good. I mean, we were living on food rations from the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. But what was really devastating, of course, was the loss of home and homeland. My father, for example, could not deal with the situation of finding himself suddenly or cataclysmically, if you wish, transplanted to Lebanon and transformed into a person standing in line to get his food rations every month, when quite recently he had been a self-sufficient working man in Palestine.
Would you say that move politicized your family?
Politicized me, certainly, but crushed and devastated my father to a point where a few years later he wished himself to death, so to speak. He couldn't deal with the sudden transformation from a self-sufficient Palestinian man to a destitute individual who was living, as he used to say, in the land of others. He couldn't deal with that. And within years, his hair had turned gray from jet black, and he acquired a kind of hunch. Finally, he wished himself to death.
And how did that politicize you?
It turned me into a fire-breathing radical, as simple as that. I grew up in the streets of Beirut, and the streets of Beirut radicalize you because you grow up in the streets, you live in the streets, you acquire your consciousness in the streets, you acquire your idiom, your metaphor, and finally your values in the streets, and you become politicized without you knowing what politics is all about.
In the camps, were you able to go to school?
Yes, I did go to school for a short while. Schools that were sponsored by, again, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. But really, in the end, I turned back to the streets, which I loved desperately. I peddled anything from chewing gum to ice cream. I hustled in the streets. I'm your typical, indeed quintessential street kid when I was growing up in Beirut.
What effect, then, did exile have on Palestinian traditions, on custom?
Well, on the one hand, it brought about a kind of clinging ever so more desperately to what we had left behind. In other words, although we were growing up in exile, Palestine became even more vivid, more graphic in our minds. Let me give you a little story, and very brief, if I may.
Go ahead. At
one time when I was going to school, I joined the Boy Scouts. I loved the idea of being at school because I had been in the streets for so long, and now I was back in school, and I loved to pedal to save enough money to be able to afford to go to Cyprus with my fellow Boy Scouts. But 2 days before the trip was supposed to take place, the principal came into the class and he said, the Palestinians here cannot go on this trip because you people are stateless, you have no passports. So when I left school and went back to the refugee camp that day, I did not actually go back to the refugee camp. I went back to Palestine in a way.
Hmm.
I went back to my to cling ever more tenaciously to what we had left behind, which as we were growing and growing up, the imagery of Palestine acquired even more magnitude and more metaphoric affinities with our soul than it had had in the past before we left it.
You tell a story about your sister Jasmine, who really had no time for some of these traditions. She kissed a boy,
mm-hmm.
and your brother beat her for that.
Yes.
She later slept with the boy.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to her?
Well, her fate was similar to the fate that usually would be meted out to kids like her who do that in our part of the world. Namely, she was killed.
Describe what happened, because this happened in your own home.
It happened in my own home, and this has happened in many homes in our part of the world. You see, you have to keep in mind that our culture, not just Palestinian culture, but Arab culture in general, is not only patriarchal, but neo-patriarchal, or what I call in my book, neo-backward. In other words, it has the trappings of modernity, but of course, deep down, it's actually patriarchal and traditionalist. We are still tyrannized and victimized by our traditions, repressive traditions. And one of these is the repression of our libidinal or sexual drives, our commitment to freedom, if you wish. And so what my sister did was, in our type of culture, in our traditionalist patriarchal culture, was unpardonable. For a girl to actually go to bed with a boy is something that is beyond all rational understanding. It is something that is totally unspeakable in our part of the world. And the punishment meted out to girls who do that sort of thing is terrible indeed.
Well, what happened was that your brother poisoned her.
My brother gave her a cup of poison and asked her to drink it. And the dreadful thing about this whole experience, Marty, is that my own sister didn't seem to think there was anything venomous or anything unusual about this. It was taken for granted that she had done something unspeakable, the punishment for which was death.
And what you're saying, then, is that what happened to your sister was part of a tradition. I mean, this was not unusual in your family.
No, this is not unusual, not just in my family. It's not unusual in my culture. And this is what we, Palestinian Democrats, Palestinians who want to transcend our traditionalism, our repressive neo-patriarchalism, this is what we are fighting against. We are fighting against this repressive set of traditions that have enslaved us and tyrannized us and, above all, prevented us from being able to meet the challenges of modernity in our part of the world. This is, I submit to you, Marty, this is why we, Palestinians and Arabs in general, have not been able to score one single diplomatic, military victory in our part of the world over the last 100 years. We are still mired in our traditionalism.
Now, the way you write about what happened to your sisters is what she had done was to dishonor the family. How does honor apply to women and how does honor apply to men? What does that mean?
Well, there's a dichotomy, of course, indeed a plus-minus dichotomy between the definition of honor as it applies to men and the definition of honor as it applies to women. For a man to be able to brag about his sexual exploits is fine. For a woman to even begin to hint at her femininity, let alone at her sensuality, would be something unpardonable in our part of the world. For a man to be obscene among his comrades, among his friends, to be obscene, to be loud, to be obnoxious, is fine. But for a woman to even begin to be loud among men, to even begin to communicate her feelings in explicit semantic fashions that are challenging would be totally unacceptable in our part of the world. For women, it is preferable for them to express themselves in the gestural rather than the linguistic.
What do you say, though, to people who, and I've heard this, that say that Arab women are safer in their own world than Western women are in their world? And if you look at the numbers of women who have been raped in America or other Western countries, it far exceeds the number of women who have been raped in the Arab world.
That may be so. I have no statistics to support that. But a great many rapes in our part of the world are not reported to the police at all because of the shame factor. You see, we come from a shame culture. For someone's daughter or someone's wife or someone's sister, should she be raped, the idea of reporting that publicly, let's say in this case to the police, would be unheard of. So I'm sure that a great many rapes do take place in the Arab world, including sexual abuse, you know, of members of the female members of the family by their, say, fathers or whatever, are not reported in the Arab world. So it's not true that this is, in fact, the case.
Let me ask you about the effect of your sister's death on you and what that did for you in your, I guess, loyalty to both your family and also to tradition.
Look, what happened to my sister has been probably one of the most crushing experiences in my life. I was not aware of its significance and its impact on my repertoire of consciousness at the time it happened. But as I grew older, and as I transformed intellectually and emotionally over the years, I came to see that as a metaphor of the repressive and antiquated mores of our culture. It has brought about a dramatic transformation in my perception of our historical and social reality. And finally, it led me to rebel against Arab culture in general and Palestinian culture in particular.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a very short break. And my guest on Fresh Air is Fawaz Turki, and his new book is called Exiles Return, The Making of a Palestinian American. And we'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Fawaz Turki, and his book is called Exiles Return. Let me shift gears, if I can, here, and talk about your involvement with the Palestinian nationalist movement. You lived in Australia for a while. You went to Amsterdam, and quoting from your book, you said when you got to Amsterdam, you wanted to be Palestinian again.
Actually, no, that was when I left Amsterdam and went down to Paris.
Okay. But what was it about the Palestinian nationalist movement? What did that offer you?
Well, I mean, it's not that I joined the Palestinian movement, I wasn't asking myself, what is this movement going to offer me or what's in it for me? I was driven by a kind of inward preoccupation within me that I had no control over to rejoin my people, so to speak, after an absence, both physical and emotional, from them for a long time. I just felt the need to be part of that culture again.
Tell us about your first contact with the PLO.
Well, of course, at the beginning, I turned a blind eye and a deaf ear to all the corruption that I saw around me, because I was your typical 1960s flower child revolutionary, so to speak. I was supposed to be serving the cause, and I didn't care about the excesses that I saw around me manifested by PLO officialdom. But as the years went by, as my daily interaction with this group of people became more intimate, I could see all the ineptitude and cynicism and lack of revolutionary ethics by these people.
What were some of the excesses?
Well, I mean, very simply, how would you like to visualize this image, Marty? A PLO official flying the Concorde with a Samsonite full of cash that he would use for his own personal expenses. I mean, I have seen that with my own eyes.
Was it an organization you think that was corrupt top to bottom?
It was corrupt top to bottom. And if an idealist like myself and other Palestinians joined the PLO in droves, Palestinian idealists and dreamers and true genuine revolutionaries, a great many of these people would become corrupted by the temptations of power, money and prestige offered by the PLO, whose coffers were stuffed full of petrodollars.
Were you tempted and corrupted?
No, I was not. I'm happy to say that I was not corrupted by this. On the contrary, I became so alienated from the PLO that I finally left in disgust.
So when Yasser Arafat joined Prime Minister Rabin on the White House lawn last fall and shook hands, when the two men shook hands, what was that effect on you? Did that make that a bogus event?
No, it didn't make it a bogus event at all. What I was thinking about was the following. Although Yasser Arafat and PLO officialdom are corrupt and inept and cynical and so on and so forth, the challenge is ours. We, the Palestinian people, have to take this peace agreement, regardless of its limitations, and show ourselves, indeed show the world, that we can go beyond these limitations. We can make a go economically in the West Bank and Gaza. We can introduce democracy. We can, above all, when I say we, meaning Palestinian Democrats, we can bring about dramatic transformations in the mores of Palestinian popular culture, and we can go beyond these limitations.
How?
Well, we have to. I mean, we have to look at the existing facts on the ground, namely that we have an economic mess. We have a patriarchal culture. We are destitute. We have to go forward. We have to bring about the emergence of a truly democratic, independent Palestinian state in our part of the world. And we have to look at all the challenges that are before us and try to meet them head on.
You criticized the PLO, and I know from reading your book that you interviewed a member of Hamas, one of the more radical Palestinian groups. Do you see them as a serious threat to stability in that region?
Do I see them as a serious threat? I see them as serious. These people have been consistent, regardless of their ideological bent. It seems to me that if we in Palestine are going to create a democratic society, then we should allow this society to be imbued with as many ideological currents and political sensibilities as exist in our community. We cannot say to these people, hey, just because we do not agree with your ideological bent, you cannot be part of the public discourse, of the public debate. If, hypothetically, in the future, when we have elections, Hamas, as a faction in Palestinian society, wins the elections, then so be it. There's nothing we can do about it. If we truly are going to have a democratic society, we cannot turn to people like Hamas or to people like Palestinian Marxists and so on and say, hey, we can't have you here as being part of the public debate.
You ask in your book, and looking at the Palestinian history, you say, why has failure constantly dogged us? Mm-hmm. If that has been so much, from your point of view, the history of the Palestinian people, what are your thoughts about the future and about the creation of a homeland and possibly statehood?
Okay. Well, look, a new generation of Palestinians. I say, notice, a new generation of Palestinians, not another generation of Palestinians, is now on the scene, both in the home ground and in exile. Now, these people, especially in the West Bank and Gaza, This new generation of Palestinians have had their sensibility develop and transform at the whetstone of the Intifada. These people, all in their late 20s and early 30s, all cut from the same a quarry of shared struggle and kinship of vision, are a people who are going to, I'm convinced, going to break on through to the other side. They are going to be the generation that will bring about an end to the neo-patriarchal ways that have afflicted our culture and held it back from its right to be part of the global dialogue of cultures, to be part of the process of transformation in the new century.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty.
Fawaz Torki's book is entitled Exile's Return. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.